Having discovered that city living is easy living, wild animals are moving into town where they pit neighbor against neighbor in nature wars that lead us to ask, should cities encourage wildlife?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 798th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Guaymas who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, we were walking the dog through an upscale neighborhood of Billings, Montana recently when wife Marlene said, "Look at that buck deer." Sure enough, there stood a handsome young forked-horn next to an open gate in the yard of a nice home that had been obviously abandoned in the housing crisis some months previously. The buck was happily eating the landscaping as if in full legal ownership of the house and its grounds. Having grown up in Billings on a diet rich in wild venison, that citified buck stopped me in my tracks as he was a perfect candidate for the freezer. We stared at each other for several long moments. I then moved closer, expecting him to bound away. But the buck was without fear and did not flee. On the contrary, he seemed to be daring me to take just one more step onto his property. Well, okay. I left the buck in full possession of the house and all its delicious landscaping. Wild animals have discovered what people long ago discovered, the safety and security of living in cities. As author James Sturba says, it is very likely that in the eastern United States today, more people live in closer proximity to more wildlife than anywhere on Earth at any time in history. Wow. In fact, wildlife running wild now costs $28 billion in damage every year in the United States, with $1.5 billion of it caused by you and I running into deer. All this carnage now pits neighbor against neighbor in nature wars that lead us to ask, how did wild animals come to live with us in cities? Why are residents of the city so welcoming of wild animals? And should cities encourage or discourage wild animals? Well, here to help us hunt for some answers, we have none other than James Sturba himself. Jim, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
It's great to be with you. Please call me Jim.
Jim it is. Now, I've been a long fan of yours in the Wall Street Journal. How long have you written for the Wall Street Journal?
I started in 1982, and I've been there ever since.
Wow. A lot of writing. And so you've written a book called The Nature Wars. I just have to ask you. Now, you're upstate New York, right? Up the Hudson someplace right now?
I am in Dutchess County, eastern Dutchess County, about 90 miles north of New York City, right on the New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts line.
Okay, lots of trees there. I bet you find some deer there, huh?
I was out this morning because it's opening morning of deer season in New York State, and so I was out back sitting as the sun came up, and I saw a total of five deer in about an hour, and there's plenty more out there.
Well, Jim, you wrote this book called The Nature Wars. What incident, you know, what caused you to say finally say, that's it, I'm going to write a book called The Nature Wars?
I started looking into this subject when I went to work for the Wall Street Journal in between commutes to Asia, which is what they hired me to do, to cover China and the rest of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But they allowed me to live in New York, and while I was in the States to write about stories here, so I began looking into some of these subjects. I started, I think, with deer hunting. I noticed that there were about 11 or 12 million deer hunters in those days, which is more armed firepower than in the 10 or 12 largest armed forces of the world combined. And I thought that was a bit astonishing. Pennsylvania has twice as many as the U.S. Army. The deer population was continuing to grow, and people were beginning to report deer vehicle collisions, and so I was trying to figure out why, and then I realized that deer hunting was beginning to decline, and that the population of deer had gotten to the point where hunters really couldn't control the increase in many areas, especially in you call them cities, I call them sprawl. And
sprawls,
that is,
yeah.
There's this huge donut between urban downtown urban areas and working farms.
Right.
And this in-between used to be full of small family farms, and they looked after their own landscapes, and they controlled the animals that were damaging to their crops and livestock and so on. But they all disappeared, and in their place came a lot of trees and then a lot of people, so that by the year 2000 census, an absolute majority of Americans lived not in cities and not on farms, but in this great sprawling area in between. And in those areas, no wonder the deer just look at you. They have no fear of people because people have largely taken themselves out of the predation business by peppering their landscape with laws and rules against things like firearms discharges in the name of safety. I mean, I certainly understand their concerns. But as a result, the huge swaths are off limits to essentially the deer's only predator. Coyotes kill a few fawns and bears, and there are other things, but wolves and cougars are the only species that really count on eating deer to survive, and they're not anywhere near where I am yet, although a cougar showed up in Connecticut last year from South Dakota.
And must have taken the train, huh?
And there are wolves, occasional wolf in Massachusetts, down from Canada and so on, but they're really not here in numbers. The thing is that what I found really fascinating was that there's some evidence to suggest that since the end of the last ice age, humans have been the biggest deer predators historically. The Paleo-Americans, Native Americans, and then Europeans. Remember, we went through this huge about three centuries of kind of mass slaughter of all wildlife.
Well, let me go back a little bit to something you said about deer hunters, because I was raised as a deer hunter in Billings, Montana, and you know, seeing that deer, this was in the city limits of Billings, Montana, in a really nice upscale neighborhood, and there he stood looking at me completely without fear. And it was the perfect candidate, like I said, for the freezer, a young buck, a great meat. You know, it was really a handsome looking animal, and yet without fear. And throughout, you know, that town of Billings, there are animals that are just moving into town. My sister lives in another neighborhood that's just kind of right close to a golf course, and she has pronghorn antelope now that are as every bit as pesky as I don't know, a pack of neighborhood dogs. You know, they're eating all of the landscaping. In the winter, they knock at your front door and ask to sleep in your bed. So they're really becoming acquainted and accustomed to living in town.
Including many species that we always thought were very people shy, like coyotes and wild turkeys.
Right.
They've adjusted really well to the landscape we occupy, and for good reason, because our habitat's better than theirs in many cases. We put out all this food, we have water, we have edges with our landscaping, hiding places, and no predators. So there's every reason for them to prefer, and a lot of people put out food for species that they shouldn't.
Right, right.
I know in coyotes, people put dog food out for them. bears get in your garbage, and then somebody says throw it a donut, take its picture. Pretty soon, these creatures associate the smell of humans not with fear but with food, and they're going to come back because they're always looking for food. And then the bear breaks into your back porch and or your back door,
and then things start to get
911.
Things start to get really interesting, and we're going to take a quick break. We're with Jim Sterba, who is the author of The Nature War. So when we get back, we're going to kind of talk a little bit about what these wars are. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. And, hey, you guys are invited to participate today if you so desire. The question we're going to put on the table for you today, which animal would you most like to evict from your neighborhood? Do you have any? I bet you do. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. The phone numbers today, 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. Here's your chance to talk with Wall Street Journal's Jim Sterba and Michael Olson. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie benchlands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, is it possible that, as Jim Sterba says, that it's more likely that people on the eastern seaboard of the United States, it's more likely that they live in closer proximity with more animals than ever before in the history of man? Can it be that there's that many people mixed with that many animals? Well, how did it come to be, Jim Sterba, that there could be so many wild animals in living in such close proximity with so many people?
Three things happened in a nutshell. About 150 to 175 years ago, trees began recolonizing abandoned farmland in New England and then slowly elsewhere in the East. And then about 100 years ago, after this era of extermination by commercial hunters of most wildlife that had any kind of commercial value, the conservation movement began to restore habitat, began to restock them with species that were almost wiped out, getting beavers from the Canadian outback and bringing them to the Adirondacks and so on, and deer from Michigan to Pennsylvania and so on. And then 50 years ago, after the end of the Second World War, people began to sprawl out of the cities into the countryside, first starting in the on the edges of cities, but then going further and further out, and the roads were improved, and you could live further away and commute to your job, and pretty soon you had people, trees, and rebounding populations of wildlife living together. If you draw a line around the largest forest in the United States, which is the eastern forest, you have about 60% of the forest and about 60% of the population. That's about, 210 million people. And that's also the heart of the white-tailed deer's historic range, and maybe there are, nobody knows, but 30 to 50 million whitetails now, and 4 or 5 million, more than that, Canada geese, but maybe 4 million of them here. Turkeys, beavers, and then bears are coming back. Moose, there are 100 moose in Connecticut now, and over 1,000 in Massachusetts, and then all sorts of little stuff, of course.
Of course. Now, let's go back to the Great Wipeout. There was a time here in the United States where we took great pride in shooting everything. Being a Montana boy, the wiping out of the buffalo, of course, comes to mind. But we seem to go through this phase in our history where we shot everything in sight.
That's because we thought that there were endless supplies of everything. The same thing happened with our trees. It wasn't until the end of the 19th century when somebody in Washington said, "Oh my gosh, we're killing our forests faster than they're growing back, and we're going to run out of wood. What will that do to us?" And then it was the same way with wildlife. Just think of it. There may have been 30 million deer whitetails when Columbus arrived, and they were killed down to maybe 350,000 by the end of the 19th century. Turkeys, tens of millions of wild turkeys that were down to, by 1920, less than 30,000. Same way with ducks and geese and beavers, the first commodity animal in this country. I mean, by some estimates, hundreds of millions of beavers, but beavers were trapped because their pelts were valuable and sent to Europe. Essentially, beaver pelts were a currency, and they were used to pay for the cost of transporting settlers to this country. So, as populations increased, as immigrants poured in from Europe in the 19th century, there was much more need for cheap protein, for feathers,
a source of protein for a long time there, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, sure. For settlers, if you went out on the landscape and you carried a little flour and a few essentials, but you lived off the land until you cleared enough forest to grow your own crops and then bring in your own livestock. So, oh sure. I mean, and these market hunters, I mean, they were selling meat and to restaurants, to
right.
meat markets, to homes, to railroads, to logging camps.
Here in California, they have these great duck hunts where they would go out and shoot like several million ducks at one time and sell them to all the restaurants in the Bay Area for their ducks. That's the way they used to harvest the ducks.
That's what happened to passenger pigeons until they were, you know, they,
wiped
they
out.
Became.
Well, you mentioned how conservation started bringing a lot of these animals back, but also did not. Legalized hunting, wherein we started charging people for hunting licenses and then using that money to establish, you know, fish and game departments that actually started managing the harvesting of wild animals. Didn't that have a lot to do also with bringing back our wildlife populations?
That's what the conservation movement did, essentially. First of all, they had to outlaw market hunting. And they did it politically by saying, okay, we're not going to allow these people to kill off what should be your wildlife. The wildlife should belong to everyone. It should belong to all the people. And we will manage it for you as state and federal fish and game people.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to take advantage of it, you have to follow rules. If we say you can only hunt ducks for 2 weeks in October, you have to obey those rules. If we say you can only take two ducks a day, you have to obey those rules or pay the consequences. And by putting in this, which was called the North American model, we gradually enforced the end of market hunting and began a scientific kind of wildlife management. Which
so it's now elite. It's now illegal, as I understand it, to sell wild meat, right, on the commercial market.
Yeah, it's illegal to sell any kind of wildlife, but, you know, restaurant menus are full of wild this and wild that, mm-hmm. but that's sort of a fib. It's all that stuff that's sold is farm-raised. And, in fact, most of the deer that's on restaurant menus comes from New Zealand. So you can't sell. You can eat it yourself. You can give it away. One of the problems with controlling the deer population now, for example, is that as populations have risen, states have, let's say, increased the season. You can kill, in some states, you could take a deer every day for about 3 months. So you could, in theory, kill 90 deer. What would you do with them? Once your freezer's full, you don't, I mean, hunters, I mean, people have various attitudes about hunters, but they're not killers. They're not gratuitous killers of these magnificent animals.
So, and this, of course, is where we're going, where we're heading down the line here, is the evolving relationship between people, city people, and hunters. Given the tremendous explosion in the populations of wild animals and whatnot, and one of the interesting things you point out, nature wars. But there it is. So we have this tremendous regeneration of wildlife. And where are they going to go? We're moving out and they're moving in at the same time, right?
That's right. And so what's happened is that the landscape has to be managed somehow. And some people say, if we just leave it alone, let all these creatures live in happy, wonderful little lives all together with us, everything will be fine. But in fact, they do a lot of damage, and it not only to us, but to the ecosystems in which we all live. And the bottom line is that somebody's got to manage these things for the good of the plants, the animals, and the people who exist on them. And I think we're probably better at it than, in the case of forest management, we're better at it than white-tailed deer, which eat out the understory and threaten the birds that live there and the little animals, and really design the forest and tell us what our forests are going to look like 100 years ago from now. They eat out, for example, oak seedlings. They love little oak trees.
We're going to take a quick break, Jim, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about why cities are so welcoming of all these wild animals and the consequence of what happens when we welcome them all in. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with author Jim Sterba. Nature wars. What happens when wild animals move together with people, and people say to their friends and neighbors, we should do this. No, we should do that. Right back after these messages. Well, 2,000 coyotes now live in Chicago. The raccoons, or so I think I've read this in the Wall Street Journal, are taking over New York City. It's a fact that animals and people are moving together. We moving kind of out into their countryside, and they kind of moving into the city. And if you think about it, why not move into the city? The living in is easy. There's lots of wonderful landscaping you can eat, much more so than out in the country. And it's safe. There are laws to protect everybody and everything. So if you think about it, why not move into the city if you're an animal? And when you do, what do the city people do about you? Well, that's the question today, and the question is, why are we so welcoming of all of these critters, Jim Sterba?
Well, they're wonderful to have around, and they've been so rare for so long in the 20th century that it's nice to see them. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, even in the 70s, in many areas, if you saw a white-tailed deer, it was such a rare sight that it sometimes made the local newspaper. These are great things to have around, but now we're welcoming maybe, but we're also killing these poor creatures by the millions a day with our cars on the roads and highways. And
4,000 a day, we're hitting.
No, millions, and we hit 4,000 deer a day, and we, you know, all the other little things that are out there. We don't even pay any attention when we run over a raccoon or an opossum or something like that. So we inflict on them a great deal of carnage, but we also like them, and we aggregate them to our little patches of the landscape. I mean, if we put out bird feeders with bird seed, you're attracting not only birds but lots of other things, and pretty soon you begin to have problems with these creatures, and the way you deal with those problems is, number one, you hire a nuisance wildlife mitigation company. These companies are booming in this country, If your city has a deer problem, you may, or any other kind of problem, you may hire these companies. To Columbia, South Carolina, for example, is spending $1 million. Those are taxpayer dollars to clean beavers in their dams out of their storm sewers and drainage systems. We're paying the price for this in more ways than one.
You know, I think of being, when I was growing up in Billings, Montana, and I had a paper route, though I did not distribute the Wall Street Journal at the time, I did get up very early in the morning and deliver papers, and I can remember clearly the geese, Canadian geese, flying over Billings, heading north or south, and they're honking as they flew over the city. It was kind of really dramatic stuff, but they quit flying over the city and just, like, moved into town now, and geese no longer migrate, do they?
This is a fascinating story, and the reason they don't migrate goes back to the market hunting days. When people killed geese commercially, even some hunting clubs used to have flocks of live decoys, live geese that they kept in pens and so on. And then when they went out hunting, they took the geese out to the fields or the water or wherever they were going to hunt them, and they kept them around. And when those geese were trained to, when they saw or heard migrating geese, to start honking and to bring those migrating flocks in so the hunters could kill them. They also used, you know, wooden decoys like we know, but they used these live flocks. And in those live decoy flocks weren't outlawed until 1935. And by that time, migrating flocks were so low that hunting them was banned for decades in some places. But the state fish and wildlife people and the feds were so anxious to restock, to rebuild these geese flocks, that they took these live decoy birds by the tens of thousands and put them out in refuges all around that they had built. And the geese prospered locally. It was hoped that they'd join the migrating flocks, but they didn't, because essentially they were home. You migrate to where you were born and learned how to fly. Well, all these decoy flocks were born locally, raised locally for 20, 30, 40 generations. So there was no reason for them to join the migrating flocks, and those are the resident Canada geese that are giving us so many problems. They never migrated, and their populations grew twice as fast as the migrating flocks, because they essentially live in a predator-free environment on a golf course or on a kid's soccer field or a park or a corporate lawn somewhere.
Are they ever messy. Goodness sake.
They're more of a mess than they are a danger, but... But
they're a great example of what you call the nature wars, because here we have geese that no longer migrate and have moved into the city and live happily ever after in our recreation areas, essentially in our ponds and our parks and whatnot. And you have some people going, nice, nice little duckies, and they take their bread out there and they feed these critters. And the population of the critters expands and grows. And you have other people are going, oh, man, what a mess. How are we going to get rid of these geese? And so you have an interesting little conflict there, right?
Well, yeah, people divide up into for or against. I call them species partisans, where you divide up in your town or your neighborhood, you know, don't do anything. These geese have just as much right to be here as we do. How could you possibly think about killing them? To the other people who say, wait a minute, this soccer field was built for my kids, and I want my kids to have use of a clean soccer field. So these fights go on, and they get nasty, and people issue death threats and file lawsuits. And finally, it's up to government officials to make a decision. And then the cases that I looked at, as the problem gets worse, what happens is that something called the social carrying capacity kicks in, and that's a tipping point at which the harm or the nuisance factor of these populations outweighs the good in the public mind. And of course, the public mind is divided. But as these populations grow and become more problematic, they tip over in favor of doing something about the deer or the geese or something, and then arguments start over what to do about it. And sometimes it can take years.
And that's what we want to pick up next when we come back from this short break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here today. We're talking with author Jim Sterba, he of The Nature Wars, writing about what happens when the wildlife populations that used to, gosh, almost be extinct, have rebuilt their populations and have discovered what we discovered long ago and moving into town. Why not? It's safe here. There's lots to eat. There's nobody shooting at you. Life is very good in the city, so let's all move into town. Well, what happens when we do? That pits neighbor against neighbor over the nature wars. So how are we going to resolve these wars? Right back with Jim Sterba and you. Hey, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about all the wild animals that are moving into the city and how the city is moving out into all the wild animals. And soon, sooner or later, you know, we reach this place where there are simply too many animals, too much of a good thing, some would say. And then what the heck do we do when the beavers choke up all of our rivers and streams and dams and drainage ditches? And what do we do when skunks overrun the neighborhood? And what do we do when deer are eating all of my wife's roses? And what do we do when the coyotes are out eating all of the neighborhood puppies? And on and on and on. What do we do when we reach that tipping point when there are simply too many animals living in the neighborhood? Jim Sterba?
Well, there are a number of things you can do. You can live with them. You can get to know them, and you can take protective measures. You can make them afraid of you by not feeding them, in the case of coyotes and bears and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You can call a meeting of your township and say, look, I think we've got too many deer, and we ought to do something about it. And your neighbor is going to get up and says, what do you mean we've got too many deer? How do we know? How many deer do we have? We don't know. We're just estimating. But, gee, there were 25 of them out back of the house the other day. And remember what Justice Potter Stewart said about pornography. I know it when I see it. So maybe deer are overabundant. So people divide up into factions, and they fight for years and years and years. And then there are several options you can... In the case of deer, you can invite essentially non-lethal options for free-roaming herds of deer don't work. Although there are all sorts of people who argue that
I was just thinking about that when I saw that buck deer standing in the gate of that vacated house, eating away at all of the beautiful landscaping. And, you know, I took a step toward it, and it looked at me as like, yeah, go ahead, one more step, dude, and you've had it. And I thought, well, okay, so much for non-lethal means of getting rid of that deer. What do you do?
Everybody thinks that you can sterilize them, or, you know, birth control for deer. And there is a birth control regimen for Canada geese now, and it costs about $12 per goose per season. And, you know, you just do math, and you may not can afford that. With deer, sterilization, you know, has been around the corner for 30 years, and I bet it's going to be just around the corner 30 years from now.
How would one go about sterilizing that young buck?
You don't really bother with the bucks. You bother with the does, because they're the ones that are going to give birth. And You can dart them with a drug called PCP, and that costs, it's down to, I think, $20, $30 a dose now. You have to do it annually. But to set up the system to do it, you have to put the deer behind fences or on an island someplace. And then it'll cost you various, maybe $500 a deer, a doe per season. And again, those are usually tax dollars at work.
Wow.
So people decide, essentially, once they rule out the non-lethal possibilities, then they fight about lethal possibilities. Let's bring in bow hunters. No, they're, you know, a bunch of camoed up yahoos. They're going to kill my dog. But actually, hunters aren't a bad option because you can screen them and so on. Remember, as these communities get beyond the tipping point, they begin to look at the numbers. A deer kill about 200 to 250 people a year who are in cars. Hunters kill about 100 people a year, and it's usually mostly themselves, each other, because of mistaken identity. So deer are now killing 2 to 2.5 times more people annually than hunters. So people then say, okay, maybe hunters, maybe sharpshooters. They're very good and very efficient, and they'll cost you maybe $300 a deer.
Wow. So $300 a deer?
This is very expensive. Remember that hunters pay the state by buying a license to do what the state wants done in terms of management. And, you know, that's worked in good and bad ways over the years, but essentially hunters and trappers pay the state to manage the wild populations, but hunters have been in decline until the last 5 years, and there's been this little uptick. Trappers are an endangered species, practically. Nobody likes them. Everybody thinks what they do is cruel and inhumane. And essentially, there's a great deal of sentiment behind these nature wars, which says we shouldn't be killing anything. We should be... It's inhumane to hunt. It's inhumane to kill. But once you decide to do that, then what do you do with the... let's say you call deer, like Princeton has been doing since Princeton, New Jersey, since the year 2000. Essentially, they take the deer and take them and get the meat slaughtered and give it to food pantries and so on because you can't sell it. I have a friend who consults on deer problems, and he suggested, which is in the book, what I think is a pretty elegant solution to what you do with the dead deer.
Hold that. We have one more quick break, and we'll come back with a solution with what we do with deer with Jim Sterba and you right back. Also want to ask the question, are we reaching a tipping point where city folks may no longer look so with such disdain on hunters? Is there a tipping point there as well? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson right back. Do stay tuned. Hey, what happens when our cities go wild with wildlife, with animals, and become overpopulated and to the extent that even those who love them say, well, this is too much? Well, Jim Sterba has an answer. He's the author of The Nature Wars. But before we go to that answer, I'd like to ask Jim if it's possible that there is a tipping point with respect to how suburban people, you know, all of our animal-loving population actually comes to the conclusion that, hey, maybe hunters aren't so bad after all.
That's happening right now in Weston, Massachusetts. I have a friend who's a professor at Brandeis University who's on the deer problem committee in Weston. And as their deer population has grown, they've begun talking more and more about the possibility of bringing in bow hunters, which they're going to do this fall. And this was a very anti-hunting community until that tipping point, as you say, was reached. And I got an email from him the other day who said, you know, I swear I'd never, it would never happen, but I think hunters are going to become the new suburban heroes.
Wow, there it is. So what is the solution that you have for wildlife run amok?
Well, in the case of deer, here's one little elegant solution that a friend of mine suggested, and that is that if you Once you decide, you have to call the deer herd. What my friend, he doesn't use the word kill because people don't like that. He says we ought to institute a program of human-directed mortality. You hire sharpshooters the first year, and there are some really good companies. White Buffalo Inc. is one of them, for example. They come in, and they cull a herd by several hundred, say. And at the same time, however, they begin teaching local hunters, you know, the firemen, the cops, and a few other guys who hunt, teaching them how to do these culling operations, setting up the bait piles, using small caliber rifles with scopes and silencers and so on. Then the second year, you gradually turn this over to your local hunters. They call the deer, but instead of giving the deer to food pantries, you sell the venison at local farmers' markets. I mean, here you have grass-fed, free-range, unindustrial, antibiotic-free.
The stuff I was raised on.
Locavore protein.
Yeah.
And it's a great solution, and there are a dozen reasons why it's not going to happen anytime soon. The most important is that it's illegal to sell wild game, and until you get exceptions to that, that solution won't happen.
Well, Jim Sturba, I love your solution, except for when we start talking about skunks.
You never had skunks too? My goodness.
Missed out on that one. But, you know, eating, I guess it is the most elegant of all solutions too. And it is a way of managing things, and it's the way we always manage things. And that was the irony of seeing that deer standing in that house in Billings, Montana, where I was raised on a diet rich in venison. We used to go out into the country, and the deer would see us coming and take off in flight. And now they don't take off in flight anymore. They just stand there and stare at us and say, "This is my yard. Get the heck out of here." Jim Sturba, I really enjoyed our little stint today, and a long admirer of your work in the Wall Street Journal, a little fan of Chinese and Chinese history. It's been fun reading your stuff over the years in the Wall Street Journal. I just want to say thanks for joining us here today on The Food Chain. And thank you all out there as well. If you'd like to log in, what kind of animal would you like to evict from your neighborhood? Go to metrofarm.com and log it on there. Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.